Let me set a scene for you. You're just coming on shift. You're getting handoff report from the previous nurse. You open up to follow the patient's chart and poke around as the outgoing nurse shares with you what they know about the patient. You see that the patient has a diagnosis of cardiomyopathy. You parse apart the word cardiomyopathy. Cardio, meaning heart, myo, meaning muscle, and pathy, meaning disease, and start to conjure up an image of a distorted-looking heart in your head. You're asking yourself, what exactly is going on with my patient's heart? What do I need to know about cardiomyopathies, as in, what do I need to look out for, and what should I anticipate with their therapies? To address these questions, I have brought on internal medicine physician and professor Eric Strong. You are in for a treat, because Dr. Strong is not only very knowledgeable about cardiomyopathies, but he is a masterful teacher. By the end of this episode, you will have a solid foundational understanding of cardiomyopathies and will feel more empowered and confident when providing care for patients with this disease. Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. My name is Annie. I've been a clinical nurse for 8 years, and I am curious. I use this podcast to address common clinical questions, share unique perspectives across the healthcare team, and cover what's missed in nursing school. As you may have noticed, I've opted for shorter, more punchier episodes lately, for which I am unfortunately unable to give CE credits. I will continue to offer CEs for longer episodes, such as the one you're about to listen to. Let's jump into the interview. Have you ever considered taking the CCRN, PCCN, or CMC exams? Passing the PCCN opened up a lot of doors for me, including a job offer to a higher acuity floor and points towards the next step on the clinical nurse ladder. I studied for the PCCN using Nicole Kupchick's online review courses and book of practice questions. Check out all of her study materials at NicoleKupchickConsulting.com and use the promo code UPMYGAME20 to get 20% off all of her products. Today we have Dr. Eric Strong, who is a clinical associate professor of medicine at Stanford University and a practicing hospitalist. Dr. Strong has an amazing YouTube channel, which has over 500,000 subscribers. To me, it's an amazing example of free open access medical education, aka FOAM, something that has really inspired me to start my own podcast. So his YouTube channel is called Strong Medicine. It covers everything from the real basics like physical exam to rare and underappreciated diseases. So Eric, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you, Annie. Thank you for having me on.
I brought Eric onto the podcast today to talk about actually a listener requested topic, which is cardiomyopathy. Sometimes as nurses, if we don't work on cardiac units, we'll see when we get a patient in the morning or if you're night shift at night, that when you're assigned to a patient, you'll see that they have a diagnosis of cardiomyopathy. And if you're like me, you kind of, you have to dust off that part of my brain that learned about cardiomyopathy in nursing school and think about, okay, what do I need to anticipate for this patient? What exactly is going on with their heart? So Eric, I kind of want to start from the beginning here, just kind of defining terms. What exactly is cardiomyopathy? And can you give us a kind of quick rundown of the three types of cardiomyopathy?
Yeah, sure. So cardiomyopathy, it's a very common term to use in medicine, of course. The term has some challenges with it. And I think one of the challenges is that there's sort of inconsistency in how the word's used. So I think you know, in colloquial speech, you know, sort of in the clinics and in the wards, I think we think of cardiomyopathy as any primary disease of the heart. So for example, you know, your heart's not working because you have valvular disease, or your heart's not working because you have atherosclerosis, or your heart's not working because you've had a viral infection, had myocarditis. I think that's sort of how the word's often used. I think a pathologist would push back a little bit on that and say that cardiomyopathy is really meant to be a primary disease of the myocardium, of the heart muscle. So diseases of the valves, diseases of the coronary arteries, diseases of the pericardium. Those are not cardiomyopathy from the perspective of the pathologist, and also from the perspective of a lot of cardiologists. And then, of course, you know, sometimes we think about cardiomyopathy as any disease state in which the heart is adversely impacted. So, for example, people can have what's called a stress-induced cardiomyopathy, where the heart isn't beating properly, not because of a primary disease of the heart, but because of some type of physiologic stress, like Takotsubo cardiomyopathy or sepsis-induced cardiomyopathy, where there's some other process going on that is influencing the heart's ability to contract and or relax. And so right off the bat, there's you know, I think some challenges in defining the term. But I do think that sort of most often when people use the term cardiomyopathy, they're referring to the fact that the heart is either not able to contract well or relax well for some reason. Now, historically, we've broken down quote-unquote cardiomyopathy into three categories. You know, there's this hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, dilated cardiomyopathy, and restrictive cardiomyopathy as the, you know, three sort of subtypes of cardiomyopathy. And those are based on the notion that cardiomyopathy is a disease of the myocardium, of the muscle tissue. This breakdown, I mean, we still use it commonly. It's still often discussed on the wards and in clinic. Unfortunately, the American Heart Association, actually about 15 years ago, they've actually proposed that we do away with this classification scheme and actually have introduced a different scheme instead, which breaks cardiomyopathies down into either genetic, acquired, or diseases which are actually mixed, which can be either genetic or acquired, or which are situations in which you have a genetic predisposition, but then you sort of need a second hit on top of that as this mixed category. And although the fact that, you know, this new proposed classification system from 15 years ago, though this probably better reflects how the diseases should be classified and sort of what's actually going on, it's a bit more complicated, and it really hasn't gained sort of common acceptance or common usage outside of, you know, academic cardiologists and pathologists. And so I think we still often will talk about these, you know, the classic, you know, dilated cardiomyopathy, what that means, restrictive cardiomyopathy. Just, I think it's important to realize that how the terms are used are not necessarily consistent across all specialists and across all sort of practitioners of medicine.
Yeah, that's news to me. I didn't know that there had been new classifications established in kind of the smaller subset of academic cardiology. I thought we were all using still dilated, restrictive, and hypertrophic.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, our medical schools, I mean, our medical students, they still learn this as well. That, you know, and they come into the wards for their clerkships, and they get confused. They're like, I don't understand. This person's heart is, you know, the person has heart failure, and their EF is 20%, and the echo says their left ventricular is dilated. But then you're telling me it's not dilated cardiomyopathy. Help me understand that. And you say, well, it's not dilated cardiomyopathy because the mechanism of the heart failure is because they've had an MI, because they've had a heart attack due to atherosclerosis of the coronary arteries. And that's because the mechanism is not due to a problem of the myocardium. It's not called quote-unquote dilated cardiomyopathy, despite the fact the patient has heart failure and their left ventricle is dilated. And that's very confusing. And I agree, it should be confusing because the terminology feels very inconsistent. And I think, unfortunately, the terminology around cardiomyopathy and around heart failure is just intrinsically confusing.
Can you clarify something for me? You talked about primary disease. What do you mean by primary disease?
Sure. So this is another, even defining this is going to be confusing because, again, it's not always consistently used. So, for example, a primary cardiomyopathy would be something like there's what's called familial dilated cardiomyopathy, where you have dilated cardiomyopathy due to a genetic disease that you inherit. And that's a primary disease of the myocardium. If you were, if that person were to, if you were to, analyze that person and study them to the greatest extent possible, you would find that their disease that they have is limited only to the heart. Then there is secondary disease or secondary cardiomyopathy, where you have some type of systemic disease, like, for example, amyloidosis, which can cause a cardiomyopathy. Like amyloidosis causes restrictive cardiomyopathy most commonly, where you have sort of deposition of this unusual protein in the myocardium that causes your heart to not be able to relax very well. but it's because of the systemic disease that affects your entire body that also happens to be affecting the heart as well. And that's sort of a secondary cardiomyopathy. Now, personally, I think this is kind of confusing because to me, I would think that, you know, if you have, for example, aortic stenosis, you know, you have an inability for your aortic valve to open properly, and that causes you to have heart failure. To me, I would say, oh, that person has cardiomyopathy secondary to valvular disease. So that should be a secondary cardiomyopathy. But the American Heart Association would say, oh, no, that's not what we mean by secondary cardiomyopathy, because we only mean systemic diseases causing cardiomyopathy, not intrinsic heart disease from something other than the heart muscle. It gets really confusing. So I think, you know, in common language and the common ways we use these terms on the words, you know, something like dilated cardiomyopathy would refer to a patient with cardiac dysfunction resulting in a syndrome of heart failure that is characterized by enlargement of the left ventricular cavity, sort of irrespective of what's causing that process. So, but again, it's not consistently used.
Let me see if I understand this. So the most common type of cardiomyopathy is dilated cardiomyopathy. And from my basic understanding of this is that, for example, if a patient has hypertension, their heart has to work very hard to overcome systemic vascular resistance. And eventually there will be backup in the heart that will cause dilation and an enlarged left ventricle. So would that be a primary cardiomyopathy, or would that be secondary?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think if you asked 100 different clinicians, you would get answers all across the map on that. I think a pathologist would say that's not a cardiomyopathy at all. A pathologist would say, well, if it's due to hypertension, it's not a problem with the heart. It's a problem with the cardiovascular system more generally. So we're not going to call that a cardiomyopathy. But that gets really confusing because, like, clearly the patient has a problem with the heart if the heart is dilated and not squeezing appropriately. So I think, again, in common language, we would call that a form of dilated cardiomyopathy. But I think definitely there's going to be people that will push back on that characterization of it. I will say that from a physiology standpoint, it acts like dilated cardiomyopathy. Like, so whether or not you label it dilated cardiomyopathy, it will act like dilated cardiomyopathy in terms of the treatment you're going to give that patient, in terms of the signs and symptoms that patient's going to be experiencing, whether or not their LV is dilated because of hypertension, or whether or not their LV is dilated because of a genetic condition, or because they're peripartum and they have peripartum cardiomyopathy, or they've had myocarditis. Those all act very similarly in terms of physiology, and the treatment's the same, and what you're going to see during examination and bedside evaluation is going to be the same.
I see.
So whether or not you actually label it dilated cardiomyopathy, or you label it heart failure secondary to hypertension, like it's almost like semantics. It's sort of like just like a labeling issue.
Okay. So if we see our patient we're assigned to has a diagnosis of cardiomyopathy, that's not going to tell us much at all in terms of like etiology of the disease. It's just going to tell us, it's going to clue us in about the current structure of the patient's heart.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll clue you in to talk to what their physiology is likely doing, what medications the patient's likely to be on, what are some complications you're likely to see from the patient. But it doesn't tell you too much about the actual underlying etiology. I will say the one exception to that is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is pretty specifically defined as a genetic disease. So if you see that term hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, that implies the patient has a genetic disease causing their heart failure. But aside from that, if you see either just cardiomyopathy by itself, or you see dilated cardiomyopathy, that's not going to tell you a whole lot about the etiology.
Okay. Why don't we just dive right into hypertrophic cardiomyopathy then?
Okay, sure. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is specifically a genetic disease. It does not equal LVH. So there could be people with really bad LVH. There could be people with heart failure due to LVH, but they don't necessarily have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy as a disease. And to be honest, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is sort of interesting in that the LVH you typically see from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and one way you can distinguish it from other reasons of LVH or for LVH, is that the hypertrophy tends to affect the septum way out of proportion to the rest of the heart. And so they don't have like LVH of their entire left ventricle. They have LVH, basically a hypertrophy of the left ventricular, or sorry, the intraventricular septum. And that's what's really enlarged, and that's what's causing the patient the problems.
I see. And this is a genetic condition, something that someone is born with?
Yep. So it's a genetic disease. There's actually about 15 different genes associated with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So it's not like, you know, there's some diseases out there that it's like one disease, like one gene, one mutation causes one disease. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is different, that there's, again, 15 different genes. So for example, like troponin, like we all think about troponin as like this test that we send off in patients that we're concerned that may have had a heart attack. Well, troponin is actually a protein that's within the heart muscle, and mutations of troponin can actually lead to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So the genes that encode the different forms of troponin are actually some of the genes that are associated with this disease. So the big problem is typically that you have, again, this very enlarged intraventricular septum, which causes two problems. One problem is that you have obstruction of the outflow to the left ventricle. So the left ventricle, you know, when the left ventricle squeezes blood, it squeezes through what's called the left ventricular outflow tract, which is sort of like the exit point of the left ventricle. And then it goes out of the aorta. In hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the septum sort of crowds out that outflow tract. It's like having an exit to a room where the passage to get to the doorway is like way narrowed. And so it makes the rest of the heart have to work much harder to squeeze blood out. And so, for example, when someone is exercising and their heart needs to increase its cardiac output to meet the body's metabolic demands, the heart can't do that because there's a limitation to how much blood can pass through the outflow tract over time. And that's why, for example, you'll see, it's one of the reasons you'll see sometimes these horrible stories about athletes that have, you know, like young athletes who have died like playing sports, like on the soccer field or basketball court, and they seem like they're fine, they're doing great, and then they suddenly just collapse in cardiac arrest. And partly that's due to, again, this problem where the heart can't squeeze blood through this relatively narrowed outflow tract during periods of extreme cardiac demand. So that's one problem. And the second problem is also that anytime you have hypertrophy of the heart, there's going to be a potential for developing arrhythmias. And so patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy are much more prone to developing like ventricular tachycardia and ventricular fibrillation, which is also another mechanism of unfortunately death in some of these people.
And that's because the abnormality of the structure kind of negatively changes the electrical conduction system of the heart?
Yeah, it sets up areas where you can have something called reentry happen. Reentry is a pathologic mechanism where you have a short circuit in your heart's electrical system that allows electrical signals to propagate without utilizing the SA node or the AV node. And you see this in patients who've had heart attacks, for example, where the scar from the dead myocardial tissue in a heart attack could be a basis of one of these reentry circuits. And you could also kind of see that in patients who have scar tissue or abnormal myocardial tissue or heart tissue for really any reason. And so that can happen in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. That can happen in people who have, I mentioned before, amyloidosis. That can happen in people who have, you know, lymphoma that is infiltrating the myocardial tissue. They can develop, again, sort of like this, their heart can conduct electrical signals in ways that are actually very dangerous.
Got it. So it sounds like the two main problems are, one, cardiac output, and two, high risk for arrhythmias.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So what can you do to manage hypertrophic cardiomyopathy?
Management of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy consists of a couple things. One is, the most important thing is to sort of risk stratify the patient to decide whether or not they are, to see how at high risk are they of sudden cardiac death, which is, of course, what we want to prevent. Patients who are at only mild risk, based on things like their age, based on what part of the heart's affected, based on the physical size of the septum, on echocardiogram, based on whether or not they've ever had symptoms before. There's, you know, a number of factors that go into these prediction models. If you calculate someone's probability of having sudden cardiac death, and it's a relatively low number, Those patients might, for example, just be advised to avoid high-intensity exercise. They might be sometimes they're put on beta blockers to try to both slow the heart down as well as decrease the risk of fatal arrhythmias. And they're just monitored over time, you know, with periodic echocardiograms and periodic physical exams to make sure their condition isn't worsening to the point that they slide into the higher risk category. Because if you are determined to be in a higher risk category, sort of the two general approaches that people take is one is to put in an ICD, implantable cardio defibrillator to shock them out of a fatal heart rhythm. The other approach that people can take if they're high risk is actually to try to remove part of the excess myocardium. And there's a couple different ways to do that. There's you can have a surgery to do it, where you physically cut out part of that septum. You can have something called alcohol ablation, where they actually inject alcohol or ethanol into the myocardium of the septum to try to actually kill some of it off and try to get it smaller in size. But the bottom line is you know, if I had to summarize this, low risk, beta blockers, avoid rigorous exercise, high risk, those things also, but you either need an ICD and or you need to reduce the physical size of the septum.
So if I have a patient who has a diagnosis of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and let's say their heart or their body's under stress with, say, for example, sepsis, and they're tachycardic, that should raise a big red flag, correct? Like their heart is less able to compensate for these high stress situations.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say it was a red flag. I'd say maybe a yellow flag. that you should just be more aware of the fact that a patient with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy who develops sepsis may be at higher risk of having ventricular arrhythmias than someone who did not have that. I mean, I don't know if it would completely change your entire management, but for example, the threshold of putting that patient on telemetry might be a little bit lower.
Okay.
If it was because typically if you see a 30-year-old with, mild to moderate sepsis and they're they're stable enough to be on the floor, they're just getting a little bit of fluids and some antibiotics, that might be a patient that you don't feel like you need to put them on telemetry, because if they have no history of heart disease and their only issue is some sinus tachycardia from sepsis, you might think, all right, well, maybe that patient doesn't need to be on telemetry. Maybe continuous pulse ox or something. But in patient with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, I would have a lower threshold. I'd be a little bit more concerned because of, as you were just saying, that the heart is not able to compensate for additional stress quite as well. Just like you wouldn't want a patient with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy to play competitive basketball. That would be generally recommended against. For the same reason, you'd be worried that, because with competitive basketball, your heart's going to be beating more strongly, more vigorously. You're going to be beating more quickly. Just the same way that's going to happen when you have sepsis. Your heart's going to beat more vigorously, more strongly, more quickly. And so just like that patient would be at a higher risk of having a ventricular arrhythmia from a competitive basketball game, they're going to be at a higher risk of ventricular arrhythmia from sepsis or from hypovolemic shock or really from anything that's going to cause a lot of excess catecholamines that are causing the heart to work much harder than normal.
Okay. So it sounds like the main concern for this low risk category is arrhythmia versus cardiac output.
Do I think a patient with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy who gets sepsis, are they likely to develop cardiogenic shock because of the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? Probably not. I'd be much more worried about arrhythmia than having too low of cardiac output for the most part. I mean, you never want to make like any absolute rules. There's always going to be some patient whose physiology is going to prove you wrong. But I think for the most part, I worry more about arrhythmias than I do about low cardiac output in these specific patients.
Got it. Okay, that's really, really helpful. So it sounds like most of the concern should lie on the heart rhythm versus cardiogenic shock for at least the low risk category.
Yeah, that's what I would think, yeah.
Okay, cool. So let's talk about restrictive cardiomyopathy. Can you talk to us about what's going on with restrictive cardiomyopathy?
Sure. So with restrictive cardiomyopathy, the primary abnormality is something has gotten into the myocardium that is preventing the myocardium prevents it from relaxing well. There can also be problems with contraction, but it's often a primary issue of relaxation. What could be sort of getting into the myocardium to cause that? So it could be, for example, abnormal protein like amyloidosis. It could be iron deposition, which is seen in a genetic disease called hemochromatosis. You can have inflammation related to sarcoidosis causing a restrictive cardiomyopathy. And you can even have restrictive cardiomyopathy due to, I think I mentioned lymphoma earlier. Like, you can actually have lymphoma, like cancer cells that are infiltrating and getting into the myocardium. And that's what's causing the myocardium to get stiff and not relax really well. And those patients can end up developing a syndrome that looks very similar or can be identical to what's sometimes referred to as heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, meaning that your EF is normal, your contraction is doing okay, but that the initial problem is you're not relaxing very well. Now, over time, these causes of restrictive cardiomyopathy will also lead to systolic dysfunction and will lead to EF decreasing at some point over time, but often the initial stages, it's mostly a relaxation problem.
I want to make sure I understand the concept of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. Is it just that the percentage of blood that's being pumped out with each beat is quote unquote normal, but just the amount that's in the ventricle period is just smaller?
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Okay. That what's happening is your preload is lower than normal because your heart can't relax during diastole. Your pressures during diastole in the heart end up being higher than normal, which prevents blood from moving from the atria into the ventricles. And so your preload ends up being lower. Like, for example, if your ejection fraction is 60%, like 60, which is normal, but the volume at the end of diastole and the end of systole are decreased in equal proportion, what will happen is your ejection fraction, that percentage will look normal, but the volume of blood being ejected is lower than it should be. Plus, in addition to that, because of the high amount of pressure in the heart, you end up with symptoms of pressure overload. So those patients, for example, can get lower extremity edema. They can get, dilated jugular veins. They can feel short of breath from fluid backing up into the lungs, despite the fact that they have a normal ejection fraction.
Got it. So what can you do for these patients who have like a low ventricular volume, a restricted ventricular volume?
Yeah, it's a combination of having a restricted ventricular volume, low ventricular volume, at the same time as having a high ventricular pressure.
Got it. Okay.
And I think the challenge with treating restrictive cardiomyopathy and the challenge with treating heart failure with preserved ejection fraction in general or diastolic dysfunction is that we don't have great treatments for it, in the sense that, if you look at, the treatment of heart failure, we have all these pivotal studies about medications that have been proven to be effective in treating patients with low ejection fraction, effective in treating patients with systolic dysfunction. We have relatively few studies that have shown benefit of a medication in treating patients with diastolic dysfunction or preserved ejection fraction. And so, what we do is give these patients diuretics. We try to, optimize their volume and pressure relationship, keeping in mind that we won't get it perfect because of their underlying physiology. But because a lot of their symptoms are caused by pressure being too high, we diurese them to the point that we can to get the pressure down a little bit, which improves their symptoms. Of course, we can't do that too much, because if we diurese them too much, then we're going to decrease their cardiac output, which is going to give them symptoms of low cardiac output. So there's sort of like this balance we have to strike between diuresing them enough that they don't get short of breath and don't get edema of their legs, without diuresing them so much that now they get the fatigue that patients will experience, fatigue and sort of brain fog that they might get from low cardiac output. And there's oftentimes this very narrow window of good volume that we're shooting for.
That's tough because, correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't seem like there's definitive care for this. Like, unlike the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, where you can decrease the size of the intraventricular septum or put in an AICD, there's nothing you can do to treat like the underlying cause of this restrictive cardiomyopathy.
Yeah, well, treatments. They're not great treatments for treating restrictive cardiomyopathy as a group. Now, because restrictive cardiomyopathy has lots of different etiologies, there are treatments for each individual etiology. Like, so for example, there's treatments that are specifically for cardiac amyloidosis. There's treatments that are specifically for hemochromatosis. There are treatments that are specifically for lymphoma. how effective these treatments are is typically, they're typically not super effective. This is maybe an overgeneralization, but most treatments for individual causes of restrictive cardiomyopathy prevent the cardiomyopathy from getting worse, but they don't make it from getting better. So for example, if you have amyloid proteins, amyloid fibrils that are already deposited in the heart, the amyloidosis treatment doesn't make those amyloid depositions go away. They just help to prevent any additional ones from getting deposited, and which is a little bit different than treatment of systolic dysfunction, where you actually, if you take someone with bad systolic dysfunction, bad systolic heart failure, and you put them on appropriate treatment, and then you repeat an echocardiogram in 12 months, like those patients' hearts can look much better. Like you can have your ejection fraction go from being very low to being normalized on appropriate treatment, and you don't necessarily see that same overt physiologic improvement with restrictive cardiomyopathy, unfortunately. And patients can get better, they can feel better, but you're not going to necessarily reverse the underlying problem. You're only going to prevent it from progressing.
Okay. So just thinking here, if I am assigned a patient who has a diagnosis of restrictive cardiomyopathy, it sounds like I'm going to be looking out for their volume status as well as cardiac output.
So the three things that I find patients will report in terms of symptoms from low cardiac output, one is the brain fog, feeling just like confused, they're not thinking clearly because they're not getting good blood flow to the brain. Two is fatigue, they just feel tired, not short of breath fatigue, they just feel more like exhausted fatigue. And the third one is often, I think people don't recognize it as much because it just doesn't seem as obvious a connection to the heart. But people can actually have bad abdominal pain, postprandial fullness and postprandial abdominal pain because they can't increase blood supply to the gut after you've had a meal.
Oh.
And so you end up sort of like with almost like indigestion and sort of, again, postprandial, like post-meal stomach cramping due to lack of blood flow and in an inability to increase your cardiac output in response to a meal. And that's you know, it seems pretty extreme, but that's definitely something patients can experience.
No, that makes sense. I think it took a few years of working at the bedside before I kind of put heart failure and decreased appetite together.
Yeah, exactly. Decreased appetite. Yeah, exactly. That's another manifestation of low cardiac output.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I think that sounds really good for restrictive cardiomyopathy, which leads us to the big one, which is dilated cardiomyopathy. And I just wanted to share one of the more memorable patients I've had in my 8 years of nursing, which was, I believe he was a 31-year-old male who came to my step-down unit when I was at a different hospital. And when I got him, he was mottled. He was just purple and pale-ish pink all over. And he just looked miserable, like kind of writhing around in discomfort. And what I found out was that he had stress-induced cardiomyopathy from long-term methamphetamine abuse. He coded on our floor. I think anytime you see someone that young pass away leaves an impression on you. And I've always kind of wanted to get a better understanding of what was going on physiologically with him. From what I'm piecing together now is that he essentially had dilated cardiomyopathy. So kind of with that story in mind, can you talk about kind of the big picture of what dilated cardiomyopathy is?
Yeah, sure. So Andy, that sounds like a challenging case. Amphetamine-induced cardiomyopathy is one of the, I think, more frustrating forms of cardiomyopathy in not just in the physiologic sense, but also because, as you pointed out, the patients are often young. It's due to substance abuse. It feels like it should be completely preventable. And the fact that oftentimes patients, didn't have access to, the resources that would have been necessary to help them, curb their substance use is just, it's really kind of awful. Again, because the times I've seen them, they're always patients in their 30s and 40s who come in and just really awful heart failure. Oftentimes, by the time they get hospitalized, it's sort of like a lot of the damage is already done. And unlike, as a comparison with alcohol-induced cardiomyopathy, which is also causes sort of dilated type physiology, that tends to respond really well to sobriety. Like alcohol-induced cardiomyopathy, if it's not past like the point of no return, if it's relatively, you know, early and you catch it and the patient, you know, gets sober, their heart damage can completely reverse. But amphetamine-induced cardiomyopathy typically doesn't, and it's really sort of unfortunate. In terms of what's going physiologically, you know, this is the classic sort of systolic dysfunction that we see where patients, you know, will end up with problems with not just with relaxation and dilation during diastole, but they also will end up with problems with contraction and a sort of contractile dysfunction. And so as a consequence, you know, one of the things you see is, you know, their left ventricle can enlarge. As other patients with dilated cardiomyopathy will do, their LV cavity will be very large, and then it squeezes very poorly. So their ejection fraction, for example, will be often very low. And these patients can sort of end up with both problems of low cardiac output as well as problems due to venous congestion. And so they will have, you know, sort of the same symptoms as low cardiac outputs we talked about before, you know, fatigue, brain fog, and poor appetite and whatnot. But they oftentimes will also get really bad pulmonary congestion because since their heart's not squeezing blood forward, there ends up being a lot of blood sort of left over in the left ventricle at the end of systole. And so when the left atrium is trying to squeeze blood into the left ventricle, it can't do that very well because left ventricle is still filled with blood despite the fact that it already squeezed. And so you can end up with like this backup of blood from the left ventricle into left atrium and from the left atrium into the pulmonary vasculature. And so these patients will often have, you know, shortness of breath due to venous congestion and pulmonary edema.
So what are the causes? We talked about methamphetamine abuse, alcohol-induced. What are some other etiologies here?
Yeah, so in the classic dilated cardiomyopathy, if you were to, you know, open up a cardiology textbook and to the chapter on dilated cardiomyopathy, you know, things that's going to list there are post-viral. So myocarditis can do this. I know that we all think about myocarditis now in the age of COVID as being a COVID-related phenomenon. You know, just like COVID caused myocarditis, but before COVID existed, there are plenty of other viruses that cause myocarditis and dilated cardiomyopathy. You know, adenovirus can, for example. It can also be, there's genetic diseases can do it. Women who are pregnant, who are in the peripartum period, so both, you know, both immediately before and immediately after giving birth, they can develop something called peripartum cardiomyopathy, which is a form of dilated cardiomyopathy, which in some cases is fully reversible. In some cases, it's not, unfortunately not, but that also falls into this category. Now, there is, you know, sort of like, and I sort of alluded to this at the very beginning of our conversation, but there's this patients that, for example, have what's called ischemic cardiomyopathy, where they have heart failure due to either coronary artery disease and or the fact that they've had heart attacks before. These patients, I think, would not be labeled as having dilated cardiomyopathy, but they will act very similarly to dilated cardiomyopathy patients. So in other words, like their heart size will be enlarged. They will have the same symptoms, the same manifestations, the same treatment. It doesn't technically fall into the label and the category of, quote, dilated cardiomyopathy, but they will still act very similarly to those patients. And I would approach their treatment almost the same in terms of what to do if those patients got admitted to the hospital, for example.
So these are patients who are post-MI, mm-hmm. that there's permanent damage done to their myocardium that then causes the...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, no. You know, the treatment is not identical in the sense that, you know, people who have coronary artery disease as a cause of their cardiomyopathy, you want to address also the coronary artery disease separately. But the heart failure specific treatment, you know, the diuretics, the ACE inhibitors, the beta blockers, you know, all these classic medications we put patients on for heart failure, those are going to be the same for the patients who have had dilation of the heart due to an MI, as it will be for the patients who have dilated cardiomyopathy due to a virus or due to alcohol.
Got it. Can you help me understand how exactly does alcohol cause this? And like, help me connect, you know, alcohol ingestion to dilated cardiomyopathy, and the same going for methamphetamine abuse.
Yeah, so alcohol, for example, is directly toxic to myocytes. And by alcohol, I specifically mean ethanol. So you drink ethanol, and the ethanol gets to the cardiac myocytes, and it causes direct toxicity to them there. Versus amphetamines and cocaine, they're not toxic to the cells themselves as much as what cocaine and amphetamines do is they cause microvascular damage. So like, for example, the capillaries and the arterioles, the very, very small blood vessels that supply the heart muscle, those get damaged by the stimulants, by the amphetamines and cocaine, such that your myocytes, you know, die or become dysfunctional because of lack of oxygen, lack of blood flow, rather than direct toxicity. And then, of course, amphetamines and cocaine, they also cause systemic hypertension, like while someone's actually intoxicated. And that systemic hypertension can be quite extreme in some cases. And that also contributes to the myocardial dysfunction over time. So the end result of having heart failure looks similar, but the specific, you know, mechanism by which these different toxins causes the heart failure can be a little bit different.
So we've talked about toxins, we've talked about infectious. Any other, you know, causes of dilated cardiomyopathy to touch on?
Actually, there's one more that's pretty common that I should mention is what's called tachycardia-induced cardiomyopathy. And that's when someone has a primary tachyarrhythmia like atrial fibrillation that has been going on for many months unchecked. So essentially the heart's been beating at 140 or 150 beats per minute for months at a time. That can trigger a dilated cardiomyopathy type picture. The one thing that's nice about, like, I always like diagnosing tachycardia-induced cardiomyopathy because it's actually usually reversible. So those patients have really great prognosis in that if you just slow the heart rate down over the subsequent months, the heart function will go back to normal in most patients. Not everybody, but in most patients that will happen, which is sort of nice.
Oh, awesome. So what is the general treatment for dilated cardiomyopathy? What kind of concepts do we need to keep in mind for patients who have the dilated cardiomyopathy?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it sort of depends on where you're seeing the patient because the approaches to treatment in the hospital is going to be different than the approaches to treatment out of the hospital. In the hospital, assuming that someone's in the hospital because of the cardiomyopathy, because they've developed a acute heart failure exacerbation, the medications you're going to focus on and the treatments are going to be wanting to improve their hemodynamics. So those are going to be, what do I mean by what treatments improve your hemodynamics? That's going to be things like diuretics. Diuretics by reducing your preload are going to improve your hemodynamics. You want to reduce your afterload with things like ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers, or medications like hydralazine are going to help to reduce your afterload. And what you're looking for to see whether or not your treatment is effective is whether or not sort of these objective parameters have been achieved. Like, is their blood pressure looking better? Is their urine output picked up? Is their jugular venous pulsations in their neck, does that look like it's decreased? How does their urine output look? How does their heart rate doing? These sort of objective, largely vital sign measurements are what we're using to gauge the effectiveness of our treatment. You know, does our lower extremity edema look better, for example? So again, the medications in this category, about diuretics, about the hydralazine, nitrates also fall into this category. So medications like IMDOR, or isosorbide mononitrate, is a medication that's used for acute heart failure sometimes. Now, once someone is stable, though, like once someone has improved because you've diuresed them and because you've gotten their blood pressure under better control, and they're ready to be discharged from the hospital, and then they get, you know, are seen in a follow-up clinic, what medications are appropriate in that case? That's when you start thinking about, you know, beta blockers and a medication called aldosterone antagonists. There's a medication that people may have seen commercials for in the last few years called Entresto, which is what's referred to as a neprilysin inhibitor. It's a relatively new category of heart failure medications. And these are medications that don't work so much on hemodynamics as they work on what's called the neurohormonal blockade, where they basically change the hormones that affect your heart. They sort of modulate your heart's remodeling after acute injury. For these medications, what's typical goal is not a certain blood pressure or a certain urine output or a certain heart rate. These medications, what their goal is to try to titrate them up to the specific dosages that have been used in trials that have been found to be helpful for improving mortality. So as one example, you know, there's a lot of trials out there looking at carvedilol or Coreg, which is a beta blocker, that have shown Coreg is effective at improving long-term mortality in patients with heart failure. And that benefit is most pronounced with patients that are titrated up to 25 milligrams twice a day. So that when you are treating someone in the outpatient setting with a beta blocker like carvedilol, again, you're not necessarily targeting a specific heart rate as much as you're targeting trying to get to the patient to that dose that has been shown in a study to improve mortality the best, as long as they tolerate it. Like if you titrate upwards over a span of like weeks or months up to 12.5 milligrams, and the patient's like, oh, I'm starting to feel dizzy, or I'm starting to feel fatigued, or this is affecting my libido, which is a side effect of beta blockers, that may be a sign that the patient's not, you're not going to be able to titrate that patient up to 25 because they have sort of, their side effects are going to limit their maximum dose. And if that's the case, then you put them at the dose, it's the highest dose that doesn't cause side effects that are going to limit the patient's quality of life. But if the patient can tolerate it, you want to keep pushing the dose up as much as you can up until, again, that dose that was shown in the trials. Now, you know, as Andy, you're an inpatient nurse, and so you may be seeing this as inpatient, where you have a patient who comes in for heart failure exacerbation, and we don't necessarily transition them directly from hydralazine nitrates and ACE inhibitors directly to beta blockers and aldosterone antagonists like spironolactone on discharge. It's not like we have them on a set of like five medications on the last day of hospitalization, and then they go home with the discharge instructions, they have a discharge medication list that's totally different. I mean, that would be like actually a really bad idea to do that. We want to sort of slowly cross-taper these medications and transition them from sort of the inpatient treatment modality to the outpatient treatment modality. And so a lot of these medications like the beta blockers and spironolactone and even Entresto will start this on lower doses as an inpatient to sort of monitor how they respond to treatment, to make sure they don't get symptomatic, make sure they don't get too hypotensive. And then as they're getting ready for discharge, we might slowly titrate those medications up while we slowly remove some of the more inpatient medications only to minimize any kind of abrupt transition at discharge. So by the time someone's discharged from the hospital, they will typically be on lower doses of the beta blockers, lower doses of spironolactone, lower doses of Entresto, in anticipation of when they see their cardiologist or their primary care doctor in clinic in a few weeks. That doctor may then see, you know, check in how the patient's feeling. As long as the patient's feeling okay and tolerating the medications okay, they'll then start to increase and up titrate those medication dosages, trying to obtain those target dosages that were shown in clinical trials.
Oh, that's really interesting. So if a patient they're hospitalized for dilated cardiomyopathy and then like subsequent heart failure, you're saying that they'll likely be started on low doses of these medications like the Entresto and the Coreg that will likely be up titrated in an outpatient setting.
Yeah. And you wouldn't start these medications on day one. Like, suppose someone develops dilated cardiomyopathy and they come to the hospital, they're admitted to the hospital with this problem, and it's the first time they've ever been diagnosed with this. So they come in sort of a blank slate with medications. They come on, they get admitted on no outpatient medications. You would not start them on Entresto on day one. You would not start them on spironolactone on day one. You would not even start them on a beta blocker on day one. Instead, you would try to get their hemodynamics improved first. So for over a handful of days, you would diurese them with medications like Lasix or Bumex. You would try to improve their afterload with medications like losartan or medications like hydralazine. And then once their hemodynamics were improved to the point that you thought they could tolerate some of these other medications, that's when you would start to initiate them. You know, because things like beta blockers, sort of a classic pitfall of heart failure management is starting beta blockers too aggressively. Like someone comes in, they're volume overloaded, you know, they're short of breath, you listen to their lungs, they're full of crackles, their legs are extremely swollen, and you think, oh, this patient has heart failure, heart failure patients should do well on beta blockers, let me start a beta blocker right now. And that's a huge pitfall because the patient's hemodynamics are not going to be able to, because a beta blocker, when used chronically, improves cardiac output. When used acutely, it actually decreases cardiac output. So if someone's like on the cusp of cardiogenic shock to begin with, and you throw a beta blocker on top of that, that's going to be bad news. You definitely do not want to do that. You want to wait until someone is hemodynamically optimized and someone is close to euvolemia, meaning you're close to a normal volume status, before you start things like a beta blocker.
Can you tease out like what Coreg and spironolactone are doing? Since you said we're not necessarily targeting a heart rate here, what is the purpose of these medications?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I'm going to say that to some extent, we don't actually know precisely how some of these medications work. You know, we often will have a sort of, we'll throw them under the label of, oh, they affect the neurohormonal blockade. You're like, well, what exactly does that mean? You know, for example, like aldosterone antagonists. Aldosterone is a hormone that affects a lot, you know, things, and affects the kidneys, affects salt regulation in the kidneys, affects potassium regulation.
It's part of the RAS system.
Yeah, it's part of the RAS system, exactly. It's the end. It's the second A of the RAS system is aldosterone, and so it definitely affects the body's handling of salt and potassium. But there's something about aldosterone and its effect on the heart directly that putting patients on spironolactone who have heart failure improves their heart failure out of proportion to just modulating their salt and potassium regulation. Like how that works, like what exactly is aldosterone doing in the heart? If that's known to medicine in general, like I personally don't know what that mechanism is. You know, similarly with beta blockers, how do beta blockers affect the heart? Because as I was saying before, and as you probably know, like beta blockers reduce contractility because, you know, like beta, our beta receptors, they respond to epinephrine, and epinephrine or adrenaline causes the heart to contract more vigorously, more, you know, both contraction is stronger and our heart rate is increased. So if you put a someone on a beta blocker and blocks those receptors, that blocks the body's ability to use epinephrine to increase your contractility. So it would seem that a beta blocker would be detrimental in heart failure. And so why in the world does beta blockers, how can they help heart failure in the long term? And it may be related to our expression of beta blockers, or sorry, our expression of beta receptors in response to the beta blockade. Like maybe it's something like, you know, our body can sense that the beta receptors it has is insufficient. So it's like upregulates our beta receptors and then we end up with more beta receptors. Again, I'm not a pathologist. I would not take what I'm saying here as truth and gospel of how this actually works in the body. But how these medications, these neurohormonal medications, you know, Entresto as well, it definitely is not a simple hemodynamic physics kind of approach. Like, for example, medications like hydralazine to compare to, like that makes a lot of sense how that works because hydralazine, it dilates blood vessels. You dilate blood vessels, it decreases afterload. It decreases the amount of work for the heart to squeeze blood out. That makes sense why hydralazine should improve heart failure. It's definitely much more challenging to understand how beta blockers and spironolactone improve heart failure. There's definitely a lot more biology involved, mm-hmm. And not as much physics involved, which is sort of better explains how the hemodynamic meds work.
Eric, I think this has been a really great discussion. Is there anything else that you would like to add to it?
I do want your listeners to feel empowered because, you know, it's like when we're trying to decide about things like diuretic dosages, it's not just about eyes and nose or weights. I mean, there are also things like symptoms. You know, does a patient feel different today? Do they feel more short of breath or less short of breath? It's also about physical exam findings, like are their legs more or less swollen today than yesterday or the day before? And, you know, nurses are with the patients way more than the doctors are. Right. So understanding like is a patient like I could come in there and ask the patient, how are you feeling today? And the patient say, oh, my shortness of breath is much better. And I'd be like, oh, I guess the diuretic dose we have you on is a good one. And then I go outside and the nurse pulls me aside and says, you know, I've been with this patient for the last 5 days. And if anything, they're worse today than they were yesterday. Like they're more short of breath and moving around in the room, or they're on more oxygen now than they were yesterday. And like I would definitely, I mean, not to say that patients can't be trusted, but like if a patient tells me they feel better, and the nurse is like, no, I was with them yesterday. They're definitely doing worse today. Like, I definitely would believe the nurse over the patient's self-report because I think patients oftentimes don't, there's this phenomenon where they don't want to disappoint, not all patients, but some patients don't want to disappoint the doctor and they don't want to imply the doctor's, you know, treatment and what they're prescribing isn't working. And so sometimes they will, and also sometimes they want to feel like they're getting better. They want to be better. And so when you ask them how they're doing, they will often give a rosier picture than is actually true. Because they're trying to, you know, again, they're positive mindset. They want to get out of the hospital. They want to please the doctor, all these things. And then when you talk to the nurse is like, no, they are not better than they were yesterday. And that is like so valuable to hear. So I don't want nurses to feel like, you know, like, oh, the doctor's only caring about the eyes and nose. And that's the value that I bring to this decision is I'm gonna accurately measure the outs. And that's what I can bring to this. Like it is so much more. There's so much more to bring than just that. And we definitely value like everything else you guys are observing.
I really like that, Eric. And this can be very frustrating for nurses too, because it's almost like sometimes our patients are different people when they talk to yeah. doctors than they are with us, yeah. you know, and we'll say, oh, this patient is just agitated and they're like non-compliant and this and that. But as soon as a doctor walks in the door, they're so pleasant. And it's like, no, I've always wondered this because doctors don't see an accurate portrayal of how patients really are. And I think that's one role of nursing is to convey that to a physician. Like, all right, this is what I'm seeing when you're not there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It would not be ethical to do this, but I wish it, in some ways, I wish it were ethical for us to be able to record patients with their nurses, with the patient nurse interactions. And so when the doctor comes in, they're totally different. The nurse can be like, no, look, this is how they were with me 30 minutes ago. And that they play like the 5-minute clip of the patient like agitated and a completely different person. I think that would be really valuable for us to understand sort of like both what's going on with the patient as well as better appreciate all the stuff that you guys have to deal with.
Yeah, it can be two totally different people. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, this has been a really great discussion. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk with us.
Yeah, you're very welcome, Annie. Thanks for having me on.
All right, that's all for today. Keep sharing this podcast with your nursing friends and colleagues. It would really mean the world to me. Claim your free CE credit, and until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.